Okay, we shall.
So we're continuing our conversation about swatches and shmatas, about ritual purity and impurity, and the different sizes of cloth, of what might be susceptible to purity, what might not be susceptible. And we introduced a Mishnah from the house of the yeshiva of Rabbi Yishmael, and then there was an Amoraic dispute about how we understand the principles of that are articulated by the Tanya Dvei Rabbi Yishmael. This is basically what we focused on the last two or three classes. And tonight, we are going to take a new look at the Tanya Dvei Rabbi Yishmael. In other words, up until now, we focused on a single teaching that came from the yeshiva of Rabbi Yishmael. Tonight we're going to see there is actually another version of that teaching. And that version is now up for discussion. And how we understand it and how it's implemented, of course, we'll see, makes a very big difference. So we're in the middle of page 27a. The Gemara says like this. Omar Abaye. Abaye says, Hai Tana, Dvei Rabbi Yishmael. This Tana, a Tana is a rabbi from the era of the Mishnah, this Tana of the house or yeshiva of Rabbi Yishmael, Mapik Me'idach. So the word Mapik Me'idach means literally to take out. He kind of removes the place of the first. Me'idach Tana, Dvei Rabbi Yishmael, from the other teaching of the house of Rabbi Yishmael. In other words, that's a fancy way of saying that there is a second version in the teachings of Rabbi Yishmael from the same yeshiva, but this second version has a very different approach to things. Just to refresh everybody's memory, the discussion over the past couple of classes has been about the notion of not only matter, but also form. So form and matter means that an iPhone is technically a lump of plastic and metal and maybe a few other elements, but nobody looks at it as that. Nobody says that's a lump of plastic. Pass me the lump of glass and plastic and metal. Instead, they say, pass me the iPhone. Nobody will say to you, why are you sitting in front of a pile of pulp? What does it do for you? They will say, what book are you reading? In other words, that we don't look at the matter, we look at the form. In order for something to become ritually defiled, it has to have form. It cannot only have matter. Matter in and of itself is not conduct ritual impurity. Artifacts conduct ritual impurity. Artifacts always have form, not just matter. So when we speak about the material from which cloth is made, the material in and of itself is not what conducts the ritual impurity. It's the fact that there's a form. There's a particular form or style, and that form is able to conduct ritual impurity. So it doesn't matter if it's made in theory of silk or of wool or of linen. It matters not what the material is. The question is, what is the form? Or so we might have thought. In other words, if ritual impurity will attach itself to clothing, then it matters not what the clothing is made of. What simply matters is it considered an article of clothing or not? The problem is that thesis is not seem to be correct. And the reason is that the Torah, when it speaks about ritual impurity, discussing the concept of tzaras habegadim, the paranormal lesions, which can become manifest on clothing, which is a miraculous thing, as we talked about. So when it talks about this, the Torah clearly says, beged semer, or beged pishtan. It clearly says that we need not only clothing, but we need clothing that are made of a particular kind of material. So we need both material, matter, as well as form. Only when you have form that utilizes a particular material can it be called a beged that's susceptible for ritual impurity. This is clear. The Torah states this clearly. The question, of course, becomes, is the Torah speaking only about negoyim, only about lesions, when it provides us with this very limited material from which the clothing can be made or fabricated? Or is that a general concept with regard to all forms of ritual impurity. And this was a discussion. This is exactly what the Gemara was talking about. This is the idea of Tanna Dvei Rebbe Shmuel's teaching, two opinions within Tanna Dvei Rebbe Shmuel. And within that whole discussion, we also brought to the fore the notion that there could be a very small piece of cloth, which the Torah would still deem important, or perhaps you would need a larger piece of cloth in order for it to be considered cloth, not simple matter. Now, why would there be a difference whether something is a very small piece of cloth or a large piece of cloth? And the answer was that the large piece of cloth is seen universally as cloth, not garbage. But the small piece of cloth would only be valued by a person who is impoverished, by an ani, by a poor person. And the question is, can we follow the approach of some people, a slender segment of the population, and say, deem it to be material? Or do we say what a small part of the population thinks or feels is immaterial, and since it's not universal, it wouldn't be considered the concept of tumah? So this is some of the questions, some of the issues we've talked upon, we've touched upon as we talked. And now the Gemara is going to introduce a different Tana from the house of Rabbi Yishmael, who has a very different approach, who seems to say something very different. And the Gemara will discuss this. So the Gemara opens up again by telling us that Abaya said that there was another Tana, another teaching, another sage. Rashi says, what's the meaning of mapik me'idach? He takes out from the other one. It says, Rashi keloimar. In other words, moitzei hu misvaras idach. He removes or takes away the logic, the rhyme and reason, the opinion of the other. The other Tana, the polygoleh. In other words, that's a nice way of saying that he argues. The ashkechan. The Mirebi, the Marbi, Sha'ar Begodim L'tumah Shratzim. Because we're going to see that this Tana of Dvei Rabbi Shmuel does not have a narrow view of material. He has a very broad, inclusive view of material. He has a whole all swatches are included. All materials are included as long as it has the form of material and it's not simply matter. But what it's made of is not of particular relevance. So let's go on to business. What is this opinion? What does this teach? This Tana of the Beit HaBishmal say? So the Beit HaBishmal says like this. In the Torah, it says beged. Okay. So if I see the word beged in the Torah, beged means clothing. And the Torah is having a discussion here about the ritual impurity. Specifically, we're talking about the Shmona Shirotzim, eight kinds of creepy crawlers, whose carcasses, whose remains, are able to communicate ritual impurity. So since the Torah talks about this idea that we have ritual impurity imparted to an article of clothing, and since the Torah specifically talks about clothing and it uses the notion of the material of beged and pisht, of tzemed or pishtin, of wool and linen, so the question then becomes, minayin l'rabbeis tzemed gmalim. Then how do I know to include camel hair wool? Now, I don't know if that's very popular today, but apparently at a certain point in time, people used the wool off the backs of a camel. They also sometimes used tzemer arneves, arnovim. They used the fur of rabbits. So rabbit fur, they were able to spin the rabbit fur, and they made some very soft kind of material. There's also noitza shel izim. There's also the fur or hair of goats, which was plucked from the goats. And it's called noitza. The word noitza actually means a feather, but it's called noitza, Rashi says, kori noitza al shem she'en goizes noitza, because it is not cut. The wool is sheared, is cut from the back of the lamb or of the sheep. But the goat's hair doesn't grow long enough. So what happens to the goat is the goat's fur is plucked, and then that fur is spun, and it's able to be a form of material. I'm no expert at any of this, but Gemara says it, so it must be so. So these were apparently different forms of fabric, or different kinds of fabric that were comprised and made of different materials. And the Gemara says, how do we know that that would become ritually impure also? It just says if the sheretz touches a beged. The exact words are that the Torah says, v'chol asher yipol alav mehem b'moisam, if the material, the remains of the sheretz falls after it's dead, mikol kli eitz oy beged, if it falls on an artifact which is made of wood or an article of clothing. Now, an artifact made of wood, you wouldn't see that and say, hey, there's some wood there. It's an artifact. So if you saw that, what would you say? What would you call it? You'd say, that's a wood spoon. You'd say, that's a wood bowl. You'd say, those are wooden clogs. You wouldn't call them wood. They're not identified as wood. If you identify it as wood, it means it has no form. If you identify it by its form, you could call it whatever form it is, whether it's a bowl, a plate, a vase. Somebody could, of course, ask you, what is that vase made of? What is that bowl made of? What is the spoon made of? And you could say, that salad bowl is made of wood. So, okay, fine. But what is it? It is not a piece of wood. It is a salad bowl. So the Torah is telling us that when you have an artifact made of wood, so we know that it has to be an artifact, but specifically we're emphasizing that it's made of wood, a kli eitz, or it says a beged. Now, beged is okay. If the artifact, the keli, has to be made of wood, what does the beged have to be made of? Can it be a paper bag? Can it be a garbage bag? Is that a cloth? Is it nylon work? What is called clothing? What isn't called clothing? I once visited somebody many years ago, and they showed me behind the glass their mother's wedding dress. What's very interesting about this wedding dress is that their mother got married in Bergen-Belsen, I think 3 weeks after liberation. And she was a seamstress. And this was the silk, kind of off-white silk, that was taken from the parachute of an Allied paratrooper. And they wanted to keep that. And then she made herself a dress, and she got married, and she loaned the dress and actually made alterations for all the other young women in the camp who got married during those few weeks. So she kept this dress. It's actually a pretty beautiful dress, very finely sewn, literally sewn with her bare hands, without a sewing machine, made of the silk of a parachute. And they keep it in the family. They keep it to show the children. It's a beautiful thing. So what would you call that? Call it a dress? We call it an improvised parachute. Right? That's the question. This is what the Gemara is. Oh, yeah. All right. This is cold? No, good. Yeah, please. So the Gemara now is asking exactly this question. When it says beged, it says when the carcass, when the remains of the sheretz fall on a beged, and I don't know what this beged is made out of. The Torah doesn't tell me. So as a Torah Jew, or I should say as a Torah scholar, if the Torah says beged, but it doesn't tell me what kind of beged, what's my first line of thought? I have to find another place where the Torah identifies a beged, where the Torah speaks about a beged, and see if the Torah uses a particular material when it describes as beged. Bingo! It does! And not only it talks about a beged, it speaks about a beged within the framework of tumah v'tahara, of ritual purity and impurity. Granted, a different form of ritual purity and impurity. And when we speak of ritual purity and impurity, it's important for us to know, as I mentioned in previous classes, that there are different sets of halacha, even though it sounds overarchingly similar, and they're all in the same part of the Mishnayos, the sixth order of the Mishnah, thank you, which talks about the idea of ritual purity and impurity. But as I mentioned, there are 15 forms of ritual purity and impurity. And the rules that apply to one will not necessarily apply to the other. It's true that virtually all purification requires a mikveh. It is not true that the mikveh is the only thing that's required. In certain kinds of ritual impurity, you need the sun to set on you. In certain, you don't. In certain kinds of ritual impurity, you need a hyssop. In certain kinds of ritual impurity, you got to find birds. In certain kinds of ritual impurity, you got to find a plank of wood. In some kind of ritual impurity, you have to find a red heifer and then use its ashes. There are all kinds, so different laws. All right, so it's not a given. It's not going to be so, oh, beg it. No, it's not a given. It's not, and you'll soon see, the Gemara actually has another approach to all of this. So it's not a given. But if I'm going to see the word beg it in the Torah, I'm going to say, okay, beg it. It says kli eitz. It says an artifact made of woods. That's pretty clear. What exactly is a beged? Does the beged have to be made of something? And in another pasuk, in another verse of the Torah, that's also speaking quite explicitly about the rules of purity and impurity. Granted, a totally different reality. Nobody died. It's not a carcass. It's not a remains. It's a miraculous discoloration. It's only for appearance's sake. That's all fine. But it's talking about ritual purity and impurity. And there clearly says that oi tzemer. I pierced him. It says clearly that we're talking about wool and linen. So this becomes the question. What about Semer Gemal? What about the wool of the camels? Does that count too? What about the wool of the hare, the wool of the rabbit? And those are the first questions. Why are those the first questions? Because it's still wool. The wool made of a different material, but it's still wool. It's still called wool. People call it wool. So does it make a difference if the wool actually came from the back of a sheep or from a llama? What difference does it make? The wool is wool. What about Noitze Shalizim? Now we're going into another area. This is not wool because it's not shorn. It's not cut, but it's plucked. So if it's plucked, but if it's still spun and it's still made to make thread out of it, and then from that soft thread they make material. So material is material, and a beged is a beged. And then the Gemara begins to talk about a totally different kind of material, which is used also to make fabric. And the Gemara talks about shiryon, kolach, and sirikin. I'm going to be the first one to tell you, I'm not 100% sure what this means. There are three kinds of silk, that I do know. So I think shiryon is like very fine silk, or maybe what they call satin. I think kolach is like ordinary silk. And sirikin is something called corded silk, or like a gruff version of silk. At any rate, the silk does not come from the back of a llama, a sheep, or a rabbit. Where does it come from? It comes from a silkworm. It's a different kind of animal altogether. And the reason that Hasidim like to wear a silk garment on Shabbos is because there's something called a behema and something called a chaya. They're two different animals. There's domesticated animals, and that's one level of energy and vitality, reflective of a godly level. And then there's what's called a chaya, of a beast. And the beast is a different level. It's a different level of holiness. So on Shabbos, we kind of bump it up. We take it, the chaya has a different level of vitality. And since the silkworm is not a behema, so it goes more into the realm of chaya. And that's why al-pi Kabbalah, there, for Shabbos, people make an effort in trying to wear a silk kapata, or a silk bekesha, something which is made of silk specifically. Silk serves other purposes also. In fact, I did some research on this once. It seems that there were many shuls that had a takana, that the chazan had to put on a silk jacket. And then later on, they had chazan clothing, chazan uniform. So where did this come from? Why did the chazan have to wear special clothes? The chazan wear a talis, maybe. Why does he have to wear special clothes? So apparently, there were people that were not careful with shatnas. Shatnas, we can learn about it later on today, is a forbidden mixture of wool and linen. And it was very common for linen to be used in wool garments. So how could you be sure that the chazan is not, in fact, standing in violation of the Torah every single second of his davening, in which case he would be considered a wicked person, that he's basically violating Hashem's will, and that would necessarily compromise the prayers of the entire congregation. That's very embarrassing. Come over to the person, excuse me, sir. Yeah. What's your jacket made out of? I don't know. Where'd you buy it? Harrods. Did you check if the shatnas? No. Could I please be the chazan? I have to say Kaddish to my father. No, sorry, can't be the chazan. So it became very uncomfortable. And people, sometimes people come to shul just to say Kaddish, but they still know how to daven. So therefore, they made a takana, very simple takana. They have this special chazan jacket. Whoever wants to be the chazan has to wear the jacket. Whoever it was, the rabbi, the shamas, the person who comes once a year, you want to be the chazan, you got to wear this jacket. And the jacket they knew had no shatnas in it. So this way, people didn't get embarrassed. And there's actually discussion in the Shulchan Aruch because whether it becomes a beged hamyuchad l'tfila, a garment which is designated only for a holy and sacred purpose. And if it's a garment that's designated for a holy and sacred purpose, that it shouldn't be brought into the washroom. It shouldn't be brought into a holy place. Not because it's holy per se, but because it's inappropriate to wear something which you daven with, and then, right, it's the same thing as with the white tunic that's worn on Yom Kippur, same kind of halacha. In fact, the Taz says it has the same halacha. Anyway, so there were various reasons why silk would be used, and if you use silk, you wear. First of all, it's obvious. Silk is clearly not wool. You cannot confuse silk and wool. Today, they have this fake stuff, polyester. That can be confused, but that's a new invention. Centuries ago, if a garment was silk, you could be 100% sure there wasn't wool in it. They don't mix. So if there was linen, maybe there was linen used to sew on the buttons. Maybe there was linen used in the padding. It didn't make a difference. The garment was silk. So this is some of the reasons people were motivated actually to use silk. And of course, in ancient China, silk was the main thing. Most beautiful garments were not made of wool, as they were in Asia and in Europe. Beautiful garments made of silk. You come to the Americas, and beautiful garments are made of leather. I don't think they use them in the wool in the same way that Europeans and Asians did. At any rate, the point, clearly, silk was in use in the time of the Gemara, and the Gemara was very well aware of it. And, of course, we have the notion of the silk route.
and imports and exports. And we know that there were people that visited China and vice versa. We know there was Jewish people living in China well before the time that the Gemara was established. Even in the times of the Mishnah, we know they were living there. So what did those Jews wear? And they wore silk. And they were in communication with the Jews living in Eretz Yisrael. How do we know? Because they have prayer books. They have Haggadahs. You can read the Haggadah. And the stroke, the brush strokes, Chinese brush strokes, Hebrew that you can read. So it was clearly communication. And certainly if Ahasuerus controlled China as well, which this itself is a dispute, we know that there were Jews living there because everybody in Ahasuerus's kingdom was decreed to be killed. Okay, anyway, this is all the up. So back to the point. The point is the Gemara says this was other forms of cloth. Yes, it wasn't the primary staple cloth. Primary staple cloth is wool. But still, some people use camel's wool. And some people were using this rabbit hair. Others were using goat fur and different forms of silk. So the Gemara asks a very reasonable question. The Gemara's assumption is, the Tana's assumption was, that if it says beged, and it doesn't specify the beged, what kind of material it says beged, certainly must mean all begadim. So how do you know though? How do you know? The Torah says beged. The only other time the Torah says the word beged, and speak of ritual purity and impurity, is when it's talking about the notion of wool and linen. So wool and linen. We know in Africa, linen was the big deal. Linen in ancient Egypt, in Eritrea, that was the big deal. The big deal was to have linen. They weren't into wool. In Israel, conversely, it was more about wool. Israel, Lebanon, Syria, Persia, more about wool. So here we have the two major fabrics of the day, which incidentally can't be mixed. But the Gemara, the Torah tells us clearly that when it comes to ritual purity and impurity, the beged is the thing that's made of wool or of linen. And then it comes. The Gemara, the Tana of Ishmael is asking, how do I know about all these things? So the Tana says, I will tell you how. Talmud Leimer, it comes to teach me. The Pasuk comes to teach me. And here, of course, one has to be mindful of the fact that we believe that the Torah is a godly document. And the meaning of a godly document, besides the fact that it comes from God, I should just rephrase that. The nature of a godly document is that it will have to contain a truism or truisms that will be applicable in every time and in every place. Because God cannot be limited to a particular geography. If God's limited to a geography, he's not God. He's limited to space. If God is limited to a particular time, a particular era, a particular civilization, then God is not a God. God is a part of a particular civilization. So the Torah is going to be a document, if it is godly, and we believe that it is, that will have to be equally relevant in every time and in every place. And it means it had to be understood to people in antiquity who lived lives of cows and donkeys and camels. And it will have to be equally applicable to people who drive Broncos and Chevys. It'll have to be equally applicable. But the Torah couldn't have used verbiage, modern verbiage, in antiquity because the Torah wasn't given today. It was given then. So the Torah will have to use language of then, but it will have to be inclusive in its messaging for all times. Now this is very challenging. This is already, for a human being, impossible. Because no human being could ever say with certainty something that I know will be relevant in 1,000 years from now. No, you don't. Society could change. People would have sworn 100 years ago that marriage is a sacred institution that can never be questioned. Today, people are not interested. Marriage is irrelevant today. And just using that as an example. People could have sworn once upon a time that one thing, no matter wherever society goes, we will not just kill. We won't kill people. People won't be killed. Today, it's called a mitzvah. It's a compassion killing. Somebody wants to die. You help him die. You're a big tzaddik today. In fact, a doctor who doesn't do that can lose his license in this country. It's scary stuff. The question becomes then, is there an objective body of legislation or morality that doesn't change and isn't a product of its time? We as Jewish people believe the answer is yes. It's a Torah. If the Torah sounds antiquated, you should know the Torah sounded weird in antiquity because it wasn't from its time. It sounded just strange. A lot of things in the Torah were not a reflection of its time at all. Too many of them to list even for right now. It's not relevant. So that's one. I'm just giving this as a overarching introduction. And the other thing is, because it's so godly, is that things will not be spelled out. Things will not always be clearly delineated and explicitly stated. A lot of it is going to be given in euphemism. A lot of it is going to be given in hint. Even husbands and wives don't understand each other. And the wife kind of said, why can't you figure me out? I gave you the hint. I told you it doesn't matter. And that means it matters very much. Why couldn't you understand that? It's today, two people live in the same roof, build a family together, can't understand each other. So God has to talk to us in a way that we have to kind of learn his way of speaking. So in marriage, two spouses, they learn each other's language at some point, and the marriage gets better and better. You figure each other out. You know what they mean. No is yes, and yes is no. You know that famous story, the guy is looking and looking, and his wife says, what are you looking for? He says, whatchamacallit? She says, it's under the bed. You learn the language. So we're in this relationship with God. We learn God's language. God really only communicated to us once. And we're spending the rest of history, till Mashiach comes, hopefully very soon, trying to figure out what he meant, trying to figure out the language. The Talmud, of course, is a documentation of all those discussions. Don't try this at home, it's not for ordinary people to figure out. This is for people who really understand God, really understand the Torah. So the Tanna says that when it says in the Torah, when it's stated in the Torah, that this ritual impurity, that this garment becomes ritually impure, it doesn't say ubeged. Ubeged would be avav. It says oy beged. Now I know, you're going to say, wow, that's a big deal. But yeah, in Torah it is a big deal. If I could have said and instead I put comma and, I asked the question, why is that? It may be stylistic. It may not. It may actually have a message for us. This is the question. So the Tanna says, it doesn't say ubeged, it says oy beged. Now really and truly, this would have made most sense to say ubeged, because the Torah says the sheretz, the material, the remains of this creepy crawler, is this little animal is dead. So if it falls on a keli and a beged, meaning these are the things that can become ritually impure. But it doesn't say if it falls on keli ubeged. It says keli oy beged, a keli or a beged. And nobody thinks that it has to fall on both in order for either one to become ritually impure. So because one of the premises of understanding the Torah is that we use the most limited and most minute amount of ink in order to convey the message, and there are not only no extra words, but no extra letters even, no extra characters. So if it says oy beged, the Torah is teaching me something. And according to this Tanna, this rabbi from the genre of the Mishnah, who came from the yeshiva, from the tutelage of Rabbi Yishmael, he said that how do I know that it's really all garments? All garments. If the Gemara was written today, I'm sure it would say polyester too, a rayon. But the Gemara gives a range of things people used to use, things called wool, things not called wool, things called fur, and things called silk. And different grades of it too. So it says oy beged. And oy beged means or a garment. What does this mean? Let's take a look at Rashi. Rashi says, there's no Rashi. Okay, so it means like this. According to this Tanna, when it comes to Negoyim, when it comes to lesions are applicable specifically to wool and linen. Lesions do not apply to polyester or to camel's wool. They do not apply to silk. They do not apply to the fur of the goat. They don't apply to any of these things. It's clear. The Torah says it. Nobody could dispute that. It says, Beged tzemer epishtim. Tzemer epishtim means exactly what it says. Tzemer epishtim, wool or linen. But when the Torah talks about shiratzim, the Torah talks about the creepy crawlers who are ritually impure, the Torah does not make a point of saying tzemer epishtim. So I can come away with two different ways of understanding this. Either I could say, the Torah said, gave us the material in that particular set of halachas and that in those verses. Here it just says garment, but doesn't give us the material. So whatever material was meaningful there probably applies here. And that was actually the first Tanna of the Beit Rabbi Shmuel. That's what he said. That was the idea of the first approach, the first Tanna for Rabbi Shmuel's Beis Medrash. But according to the second Tanna, he's looking at this very differently. He says the Torah speaks about beged ufishtim, about wool and linen, The Torah is speaking about the tumah, the ritual impurity, about negoyim, and it says that negoyim, that the discoloration of the paranormal, for vision only, for sight only, in ritual impurity, only applies not only to form, but also to matter. It needs to be form, meaning a beged, and it also needs to be wool or linen. It's a special halacha. It applies only to wool and linen. Why might that special halacha apply there? Perhaps we'll touch on that a little bit later. But it's not relevant for now. The point is, the Torah chooses to spell out the specifics, so I know that the specifics apply there. What's the big question, though? The big question is, does this limitation, does this specific delineation apply broadly, or is it only with regard to the Tumah of Negoyim? That is the big question. And this Tana seems to think that if, in fact, the other forms of ritual impurity would have been limited in the same way, it would have said ubeget. Ubeget. Ubeget, just like and a beget, not or and. The and is above, it wouldn't be clarifying, delineating, saying anything unique or different, and you'd automatically know whatever applied there applies here, namely form, it has to be an article of clothing, made of a particular material, wool and linen. But that's not what the scripture says. The scripture says, oy beget, or an article of clothing. And the or gives the clothing a certain prominence, or clothing. There's a beged, that's one category. This is a separate category. The category of clothes. And since when the Torah talks about artifacts, it told us that the artifacts have to be of a specific material, namely, it says kli'etz. And since the Torah here does not spell out material, very different from the other halachas. Over there it did spell out a material. Here it doesn't. No material spelled out. No material spelled out. And it says, oy beged. There's a keli, and that's kind of an institution, a reality unto itself. And now I have oy beged. So oy beged means a separate beged. So if I have oy beged or oy keli, I have either an artifact or clothing. That means that the clothing is prominent, is important, is meaningful in and of itself. Why? Because it's clothing. The catchphrase here is clothing. The emphasis here is on form, not on material. Because the Torah never said anything about material. And if it would have said ubeged, I would say that Torah is simply highlighting, adding on clothes. It doesn't stand on its own. It's not independent. But since the Torah here independently identifies oy, that's one thing, keli, oy, or beged, I said, or clothing, no material mentioned. So if it's or clothing and no material mentioned, would it not be reasonable to say that every form of clothing should apply? The Tana, who came from the house of Rabbi Yishmael, thought so. He said, yes. That's exactly how I learned these verses. That's exactly how I heard my Rebbe teach it. That's how we learned it in the yeshiva. Now we have this dispute. We have this dispute between different disciples of the Rabbi Shmuel's yeshiva who learned these verses either in an overarching way. No, it says wool and linen must apply to all. Or because the Torah seems to give greater emphasis to the concept of beged, oy beged, it's teaching me something. What must it be teaching me? It must be teaching me that whilst when it comes to the paranormal color, the negoyim, there, it's important that we emphasize material, not only form. Here it's oy beged. The key here is form. That's the key. It's a garment. If it's a garment, it's ritually impure. What it's made of is irrelevant. If it's fabric, if it's material, and it's a garment, then it becomes tummy. So this is how Abaye introduces that opinion. Now this is going to be problematic. It's going to be problematic. And the reason it's going to be problematic is because in Abaye's world, everything is black and white. In Abaye's world, the Tana, who spoke about the wool and linen, said wool and linen. And wool and linen is ritually impure, and nothing else is ritually impure. The definition of beged, of article of clothing, insofar as ritual impurity is concerned, is that it's a form comprised of wool and linen. Full stop. But Rava disagreed. In the previous discussion, Rava said, no, 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 no. It's true the Torah emphasizes wool and linen. And therefore, we would say even three fingers by three fingers, the smallest amount, because at least there are some people who consider this to be of value. So that's because the Torah emphasizes it, wool and linen, even the smallest amount. But other things would also be ritually impure, according to the first opinion. Other things would also be, but they couldn't use the smallest amount, the smallest swatch of clothing. It would have to be a swatch of clothing which is universally recognized as a swatch of value, and that's going to be three tefachim by three tefachim. So according to Abaye, it was black and white. These two opinions, they're two different opinions. According to the first opinion of Tanna Dvei Rebbe Shmuel, the story of Negoyim is universal. It's instructive to all forms of ritual purity and impurity insofar as clothing is concerned. And according to the second opinion, no, it's not. It's not. It's very specific. It's specific to Negoyim. In Negoyim, in the lesions, in the discoloration, that's where wool and linen figures. And outside of that, all begodim. Makes no difference what it's made of. Gemara says, Vaharava, Hudamar Shleisha Shleisha, Bishar begodim. Reb Shimon ben Elazar, Rava, who explained the opinion of Reb Shimon ben Elazar, another Tana, that he learned the way he learns the Tana Devei Rebbe Shmuel, that there's a difference made between other materials, whereas wool and linen, even a tiny amount, whereas other materials, it has to be a larger amount. So Isle Latana, the Devei Rebbe Shmuel, then in that case, according to the first opinion of Tana Rebbe Shmuel, other fabrics are included too. If other fabrics are included too, then how would he understand these two versions? They're the same thing. They're not even arguing. Take a look at Rashi. Rashi says, Rava Omar. Rava Omar ki lesle. Latana de Resha, okay, one second. Well, let's do the answer. Where are we? Latana de Shmuel, according to the opinion of Reb Shimon ben Elazar, other garments would become ritually impure, depending on the size. But according to the Tana de Shmuel, that would not be the case. So how would Rava learn this opinion of Tana Dvei Rebbe Shmuel? So the Gemara says, you know what? Hoderbe Rava Miahi. Rava actually, when he saw this second version, he recanted. He recanted. He said, okay, I didn't realize. The Tana Dvei Rebbe Shmuel, I thought Tana Dvei Rebbe Shmuel has this overarching opinion where we look at everything as taken from the laws of ritual purity and impurity from the Goyim. And clearly, if the second opinion was that everything was inclusive, the first opinion couldn't be that way. So, I guess I misunderstood the first opinion. I made a mistake. So Rava would have recanted. Let's go. Let's take a look in the Rashi. Rava Omar ki lesle l'tana d'reisha, according to the first Tana. B'sha'ar begodim, but other garments. B'shratzim, let's say with regard to the ritual impurity of the sheretz. Gimel al gimel, when it comes to the smaller size of 3x3. So the yil made sasim and hamafurish. When the Torah doesn't specify, I can derive from what the Torah does specify. And therefore, when the Torah specifies it, it specifies only wool and linen. Okay, so then wool and linen would be the same thing here. But if it's three tefachim by three tefachim, which is already a significant swatch of fabric, here he would have to agree because it's included from oybeged. In that case, so both Tana Dvei Rebbe Shmuel are saying the same thing. So the Gemara says, Rava actually recanted. The Omar, and he would say, the Tana Dvei Rebbe Shmuel, Rebbe Shimon ben Elazar Amru, Davar Echad. He would say that the Tana Dvei Rebbe Shmuel, who is officially in dispute with Rebbe Shimon ben Elazar, are saying the same thing. V'lav ka Abaye, not the way Abaye said it. Ela rather, the Litravayu. According to both opinions, Bishar Begadim, Tumas Gimel al Gimel Leka. When it comes to all opinions, when it comes to the smaller approach, then Rav would have to admit, both Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar and both Tana Rebbe Shmuel would agree that that does not exist. Shleisha al Shleisha Iko. And in this way, Rava's finessed kind of distinction between the Tana Rebbe Shmuel and Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar of the previous Gemara would have to be set aside. And we would have to follow a more universal approach. The only way we can work that out now is make it two versions in the Tana Deveda Bishmal itself. Either we do learn from the story of Negoyim for everything else, or we don't learn from the story of Negoyim. So we touched upon form, we touched upon matter or substance, we touched upon rich and poor, we touched upon swatches and small ones and big ones, we touched upon ritual purity and impurity, and the notion of what can or cannot conduct it. And a little bit you have to have heard the other classes because one flows into the next. And the only reason that there's even a question here is because of what we discussed in the previous Gemara. However, all is not lost. The Gemara does come back and say there is another approach. Another approach. And that's called in the language of the Gemara, the Ibayis, and if you will, Ema. Rava doesn't have to recant. Rava has a different way of framing this entire reality, and in the new way of framing this reality, it is possible for Rava to retain his previous approach as well as balance this new information, and everything can still work. How could that be? For this, you have to come to the next class.